Yeah, no, that's okay. Yeah, I'll find out from Busy what she needs. How many chairs do you guys need?
We need four including.
Okay. So where's Busy? She probably jumped out. Let me move over our stuff.
Okay.
And we'll get some chairs.
Like I said, I'm happy to help you arrange.
Oh, we're doing public comments. I totally forgot.
Okay.
That is my fault.
Thank you.
Thank you for reminding me.
I have ever since we had this conversation, I had a chance to. Yeah, this is very wrong, but I think you're right.
Yeah, no, I will.
Okay.
All right. All right, State Board, we'll come back to order. A couple ministerial things as we enter public comment. As we enter public comment, one, the Board will not hear from any member of the public on an item that we have to treat as a quasi-judicial action, which would be the next item on the agenda, which would be the appeal of the Montessori school. So if you intend to comment on that, please don't. I'll be forced to gavel you out of order. The rules of procedure do not allow us to hear ex parte communication on those topics. It is a quasi-judicial proceeding, much as you see in front of the Public Utilities Commission, and comments can only be taken on the record. So I think please don't put me in the position of having to cut anybody off. Also, we'll have 3 minutes limited. Ms. Cordial will be the timekeeper. And so please, because we are behind schedule, strictly adhere to the 3 minutes. Let's start with Roya Brown. Ms. Brown? Hopefully I got that right. Yes.
Roya Brown. Please. On behalf of Cooperative Community Schools, I want to thank you, Dr. Scheffel, for your commitment to children in all your decisions. That is evident by how you looked at proposals, such as our proposal based on their merit, and how they will impact the education rather than from the partisan perspective. This is true for how those proposals impact not just students, but the teachers and administration at schools as well, because you know from the experience where these constituents can benefit from these new ideas. You're open to innovations that are well developed, and you're not afraid to step out in support of these fresh ideas to do things differently, as long as it will be good for our kids and their achievement in the long run. And for that, I am grateful. Thank you for the vote of confidence in our school. Thank you for your care. You will be truly missed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brown. Sherry Kiesinger. Kissinger. Yeah, I'm working on that. Sorry. Sherry.
Good morning. My name is Sherry Kiesecker, and I'm a parent from Fort Collins, and I'm here to ask for your help. I don't know.
Just have to probably get close.
Did I mute it now? Better?
Yes.
Yes. All right. My name is Sherry Kiesecker, and I'm a parent, and I'm here to ask for your help this morning. This is no surprise. It's about data privacy. I've contacted a school contract service provider, a vendor, asking about what data elements they collect and use and share, and I've asked about the purpose of the data and any subcontractors that they share that data with, because this affects my child and all children in Colorado. It's been over 2 months, and while the vendor did acknowledge receiving my inquiry, they have not provided an answer at all. I have exhausted all avenues. I've asked my school, my district, the vendor directly, and I've asked the state. I've taken every step outlined in the Student Data Privacy Bill 1423 that you helped pass last year. And now I'm taking that final step and asking for your help and please helping us find this information. The contracted vendor is the College Board, and the test is the SAT and the SAT prep. My son's middle school asked him to create an account with the College Board to take the practice SAT earlier this fall. It was also suggested that students sign up with the College Board's online partner, Khan Academy, for the personalized test prep. I asked my school board, State Department of Ed, and the vendor directly. No one knows the answer, but my district did reply. She said that we're glad you contacted the College Board directly because they are the only ones who can answer your question. And I think she's right, but the problem is the College Board isn't answering. My concern arises from the fact that the College Board has sold data historically. They license student data, and they share data with multiple third-party contractors. And they ask very personal questions like religion, race, military background, social security number when students take the test without telling the students that this is optional information. You can look at the actual test packet, and nowhere on there does it say that that's optional information. They also have other surveys that are optional, and it's not posted anywhere that that is voluntary, and it's not posted what they do with that information. Khan Academy has been harshly criticized for its data collection and sharing practices. Politico states Khan may be a free service, but users pay a price. They trade their data for the tutoring. Khan allows third parties like YouTube and Google to track students. What data is shared and profiled or possibly sold with the College Board when students take the PSAT and SAT? I don't know, but I would like your help in finding out. I find myself struggling whether or not to let my son take this test and let him experience it and be familiar with it so that he can compete with his peers, or do I keep him from taking the test so his data isn't collected and profiled? So any help you would give, I would greatly appreciate that, because it was the intent of the law for this to happen. And I do have all of my many documents that I'd be willing to share if that would help. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lynn Roberts, is this a comment on the Montessori school question?
I have my own words to share. I will defer. I understand that you don't want me to share Chris Von Lernzer's record, and I will not. I have my own words to share.
It's a comment on the item we're going to take up as a judicial matter, then it's inappropriate for the board to hear those comments, regardless of whether they're yours or others.
I would like to speak as a neighbor in the neighborhood of a Magnet Montessori school. Is that permitted?
I don't. Where's Sally?
Going pro or con towards having great work Montessori school? No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. I had another topic I would like to address.
Please feel free.
I'd like just to submit emailed correspondence dating from October of this year, requesting of iReady the data submitted by my daughter when she took iReady. She's taking it now 3 times. And I've made 7 specific requests for the data that I believe HB 1423 acknowledges my right to. I've asked my school, who complied with my request and gave me a copy of a report that is similar to this. It includes scales and, 40s. It includes scaled scores and performance levels. I've asked, so not only my school, I've asked the contact identified by my district at iReady. He did not reply to me except using the words of their counsel, who has replied to me 3 times. But I remain not with the access to the data that I believe the law acknowledges my right to. So I'm asking for your help. If you would please review the email record that is here. I did not include the copy of my daughter's record that was provided me by the principal at my school for privacy reasons. But like I said, I have a template here that shows you what they do provide. I'm really concerned about increasing privatization. And when iReady will not comply with requests that I am legally allowed to make, it's alarming to me. I would like to submit my comments on the great work matter in writing, if that's all right.
That would not be appropriate at this time. You can submit them for later distribution.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Daniel Marsh. Okay, good. Jeanette, looks like Sanchez. Yes, Ms. Sanchez. You have the Great Works Montessori listed as your topic?
Yes.
That's not appropriate for you to discuss at this time.
So not.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Gabriella Jacobs? Gabriella Jacobs, no. Okay. Pete Roybal? Roybach? Okay. Thank you very much. Darren Levy.
So is there going to be an opportunity later to speak about Great Works?
Once the hearing's concluded at this afternoon's comments, if you wish to do so.
After you've already voted?
That is correct.
Is it permissible to just talk about some facts about Jefferson County?
Probably not, if they are designed to influence the board in its decision on this particular appeal. Let me just explain to the audience that this is a quasi-judicial proceeding, just as it would be inappropriate for a judge or a magistrate to sit down with one of the parties and or listen to one party exclusively without the opportunity for the other party to present counter evidence and or cross examinations. It's because this is under Colorado law, that kind of proceeding, it's simply not appropriate for us to hear what is referred to in the law as ex parte communication, that we are obligated by the law to make our decision based on the record and the official hearing that we will have here shortly.
Which does not include public comment.
That is correct. Thank you. Okay, that concludes the sign-up for public comment. I apologize to those who came for that purpose, but it is just inappropriate for us to hear. I would also make one observation that I'm not sure College Board is a vendor to the state of Colorado. They are obligated to follow Colorado law and the rules this board has set for data privacy, so I will ask Dr. Anthus to conduct a review of the questions raised and to make a determination that College Board either is in compliance with Colorado law or is not in compliance with Colorado law, and if they are not in compliance with Colorado law and board policies, to make specific recommendations for correction. Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. We'll now proceed to item 11, which is the appeal for the Great Works Montessori School versus Jefferson County School District RE1. We'll proceed while the parties come to the table and get organized. The board may take a few minutes one way or the other to take just a short break, so because we're going to be here for an hour and a half on this issue. and proceed with item 11, or item, or whatever item, item 11. Colorado State Board of Education will now conduct a hearing in case number 16-CS-03, the appeal of Great Works Montessori School from the decision of the Jefferson County School District number RE1 Board of Education to deny Great Works Montessori Charter School application. During this hearing, the board is acting in its capacity to hear appeals of charter schools and will hold an appellant hearing under the relevant charter school appeal law, Colorado Revised Statutes 22-30.5-108. I'd like to ask the person in charge, the person chosen to represent each party, to enter your name on the record along with the party you represent. Please also introduce the persons you have designated to answer questions of the members of the board. Only those individuals will, identified by the parties, will have the opportunity to address the board. So we'll start with Ms. Edgar. Are you the counsel for the district?
Yes, Director Durham. Thank you very much. My name is Kristen Edgar. I'm an attorney with Kaplan and Ernest, and we are here today on behalf of Jefferson County School District. I will go ahead and introduce the designated witnesses that we have with us today. To my immediate right is Mr. Ron Mitchell. He is president of the Board of Education and can answer any questions about the board's decision and the district's charter school process. Next to him is Superintendent Dan McMenemy. He can answer questions about the district's relationships with its existing charters and its charter application process. And to his right is Dr. Stephanie Corbo. She is the finance director for Jefferson County School District and has expertise in reviewing charter school budgets and in the cost and operating and revenue expenses that go along with those charter schools. Thank you.
And Mr. is it Bethke?
It is. Bill Bethke, William Bethke, representing Great Work Montessori School. To my immediate left is Amy Malik, who's executive director and intended head of school, and is here to answer any questions I can't answer. And to her left is Drew D. Marie, who's the treasurer of the board and is here for purposes of focusing on any finance issues.
Okay, thank you. The role of the State Board is to consider only those issues raised in the Notice of Appeal. The Board has been provided with a record on appeal. References to documents or testimony not present in the record on appeal will not be considered by the Board. In relation to these issues contained in the Notice of Appeal, the Board will apply the following standard of review following oral argument. The Board will decide whether it is in the best interest of the pupils, the district, or the community to support the local board's decision to deny Great Work Montessori's charter application. The parties have already submitted written arguments and information. A maximum of 30 minutes will be granted for the oral argument and examination of each party's issue. You may reserve a portion of the 30 minutes for rebuttal. During this time, parties may summarize its written arguments and information, and board members may ask questions. And keep in mind, during the presentation, board members may choose to interrupt with questions as appropriate. The hearing will proceed as follows. Great Works Montessori School, the appellant, will present its arguments, including questions from the board. Jefferson County School District's RE1, the appellee, will present its arguments, including questions from the State Board. The appellant, Montessori School, shall present its rebuttal. To the extent it's reserved time, then the Jefferson County School District will also present its rebuttals. Then lastly, the board will deliberate and render its decision. We will adhere to the maximum time limit. Each segment will be timed. You'll be notified by Ms. Cordial when you have 5 minutes remaining in your allotted time. Ms. Cordial, there's with the yellow piece of paper that she's brandishing, and she's very serious about it. Great Works Montessori School, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, please.
10 minutes for rebuttal. Jefferson County, do you, yes, I'm in, Ms. Edgar?
Yes, Chairman Durham, we would also like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, those are duly noted. As is customary with any oral argument in administrative hearing or judicial proceeding, we anticipate the board members may have questions and that they may interrupt counsel with these questions. This is the only time during the hearing board members may question the parties. Board members, board questions and your responses are included within the 30 minutes maximum time. Are there any questions from the board or council about these standards of procedure? Seeing none, all right. Mr. Bethke, if you would like to proceed with the allotted 20 minutes of your initial presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This case is, in my experience at least, in these charter appeals, in a bit of an unusual posture. The resolution below passed 3-2. It was focused solely on budget issues. The charter had made changes to the budget that they thought would satisfy the district, and obviously that was not satisfactory at the end of the day. I think it's worth just briefly reviewing what exactly happened. The charter submitted an initial budget in two forms, one assuming a public charter school grant and one not assuming that grant, which was critiqued by the district, and the school went back and took those critiques seriously, revised the budget to meet the district's needs. And then there was a second round of discussion or conversation between the district and the school, in which the district suggested and recommended, really, that the school add a single elementary level classroom, which the school proceeded to do. And at that point, the applicant thought that it had met the district's budget requirements. It was very close to the time for the school board to act on the application, and there wasn't further conversation. And then the budget, the resolution came down, focused solely on a handful of budgetary issues, which I want to talk about in a little bit of detail as we go through this today. But what was clear was that the school was attempting to accept the district's critiques, accept its recommendations, respond to those, and the district, having made the recommendation of an additional classroom, I think discovered that the effects that it hoped to see in the ultimate budget weren't there, and that probably additional changes might be warranted. So I at least have a strong sense in this case, and I think it's reflected in the record, that we're at a point where there's an unfinished conversation here, where the parties exchanged a lot of ideas. We know that they exchanged ideas on governance and were able to reach agreement, essentially the school accepting the district's governance critique and accepting its recommendations for changing the structure of its board. We know that there's no dispute about the educational value of this school or about the needs of the community. The underserved community in Jeffco that it would be in. This is an area that does not have nearly as much representation of charter or other choice opportunities as other parts of the county. Yes.
Yes.
You just got to where I wanted you to be.
And as I say, I will not recognize members. They will just
yeah, absolutely. Feel free to. Much rather answer questions.
So I have several questions. They relate to the attendance. Does the school have letters of intent?
My understanding is, as of today, 185 letters of intent, with a disproportionate number of those being for the preschool.
Preschool.
Yes.
Is there an existing school already, an existing preschool already, a Montessori, or is this a fresh?
This would be, in terms of a Montessori preschool in this part of Jefferson, I'm not sure of the focus of your question, but in this part of Jefferson County, a Montessori preschool, this would be new.
This would be new, okay.
Yeah, the Montessori schools, all of which have preschool classrooms, are in kind of an arc around the county and do not reach this part of, actually, my office in this part of Lakewood, do not reach this part of Lakewood.
To what extent has this group of parents and organizers worked with the other Montessori schools in order to verify its budget, get some ideas on costs? In other words, given that there are already Montessori schools in the area, to what extent have there been any efforts at some kind of partnership to get some help from the schools that have the experience already?
It's a good question. I'd have to refer that question to Ms. Malik.
We do have relationships with the other Montessori schools in the district, and we got sample budgets from all of them. They all shared current work that they're doing in their schools.
Do they use do they use parent volunteers, for example, which is one of the solutions that you identify?
Yes, there's a lot of volunteerism.
So that brings me then to my right now last question, which is, my limited understanding of Montessori is that there's very careful training of Montessori teachers, that it's I don't want to say it's a super rigorous program, but it's a very specific program where there are specific strategies for their kids. How are parapros and volunteers trained, and what sort of resources will that require of you?
There's an assistance training that AMI, who is the standard that we're seeking to meet, they provide an assistance training, and there's a training center here in Colorado that does that training. And so we plan to work with them to have our paras trained so
that
they can work.
How pricey is
that? It's not as pricey as it would be if we didn't have a training center in the district.
And all your four or five teachers, I can't remember which now, they will be, is it certified, Montessori certified? I'm not sure, I don't remember what the license is.
Yeah, people call it different things, certified or trained or diplomaed. But yes, all of our teachers will be AMI certified teachers.
Thank you.
Dr. Flores?
May I ask you about the building? Is it a building that's there already?
No, it doesn't exist right now. There's land that has been purchased, and we're through the DD phase. There's a lot of acronyms, but basically we've designed the building. We have the layout. We've been given the grading permit, or we're just waiting on one more permit for the ground to be broken.
And where did you get the monies for this, to buy the land? Because that seems to be very pricey land.
The Great Work Montessori School will not own the property or the building. We're leasing the property.
This is a leasehold arrangement, and actually a very favorable leasehold arrangement, in which the school will only pay for the space in the building that it occupies. So it will be able to titrate its rent. Typically, one of the dilemmas in building out a charter school, especially Montessori school, but also other charter schools.
That's okay. I don't want to take up your time. Who owns the property?
A nonprofit corporation.
And who is that nonprofit corporation?
TGNA Holdings.
So it's a nonprofit corporation. You can look it up on the Secretary of State's website. It's really not relevant to this appeal, because the question here is whether Great Work Montessori has an appropriate budget. And in fact, it has a very favorable submarket rate lease, which will allow it to occupy space for only the students that it enrolls. So one of the concerns you have with any charter school, if you're trying to build from the bottom up, is you may need a building for K through 6 or K through 5 or pre through 5 or whatever, and you'd prefer not to enroll all those grades at once, but to start at the lower grades and gradually let students work up through the system. That can be a real dilemma, because frequently the space you need is not space you can afford based on your initial enrollment. This lease will allow the school to pay for the space that it uses and increase its payment as time goes on. So it's a highly favorable lease.
And so the people, I just want to know kind of names, because sometimes what happens is, I mean, charter schools are known to do this, where the money really goes to the people who own the property.
One of the advantages of it being a nonprofit corporation is no one is legally permitted to take a profit out of it. With commercial landlords and with developers in particular, that can be a real dilemma, because some of them are predatory.
That's right, and that's what I'm kind of alluding to.
Yeah, but this is not the case. This is not the case here. Again, this is a submarket. If you look at what I'm paying for office space within a few blocks of this location and compare it to what the school is paying, they're paying well below market.
Right.
Well below market.
Yes, because it's known that there are investors who invest in land. I mean, it's
you
very,
can't
very
invest
well known,
in
a, especially for charter schools, and then make a profit. Then the fees go up.
Which is not true in this case. You can't invest in a nonprofit corporation.
Well, you can't say it's not true because...
No, I can say it's not true. Legally, it can't be true, because you can't legally invest in a nonprofit. If you try to do that, you're subject to sanctions from the Attorney General and the Internal Revenue Service. This is not a developer who's taking advantage of a charter school. I've seen those arrangements. This isn't one of them.
What's the build-out expectation?
Build-out
is the wrong word. The total enrollment anticipated over time. Have you thought about that, or are you just kind of wait as it grows?
Yeah, we're planning to start with 200, and then as There's 30 in third grade that first year, and then as they move up every year, so we're adding 30 every year until we reach through middle school.
You're planning to go K-8?
Yes.
Or pre-K-8, sorry.
Pre-K-8, okay. Yes.
I think I missed that. Thank you.
Maybe we could get right to the heart of the matter and discuss some of the budget, the argument, where we have the district saying you don't have a budget and you say you do. I'd like to get to the heart of that.
I would. I think Ms. Goff had a question.
Well, go ahead and answer that one, and then we'll work our way.
That's
back.
My whole argument. So,
well, good. Go ahead, and
it'd
be a good time for you to.
You have limited time.
Be a good time to filibuster.
Okay, so let me talk about several things related to the budget. One of the provisions of the resolution says there isn't funding in the budget for special education. It's just not true. I don't know if it was overlooked. I don't know if it was misanalyzed in some fashion, but there's funding to pay the district for the typical arrangement in JEFCO, which is a kind of modified insurance where you pay for the higher needs kids. You pay a set amount per student to cover the needs, so JEFCO will step in if you have a higher needs student enroll. And then you have to develop in-school capacity for mild to moderate needs students. And there's a specific budget for that and we set it out in the brief with the allocations for the occupational therapist and the speech therapist and the instructional specialists. That's all included within the budget. So that's just simply an error. And the district, as I saw it, didn't even attempt to defend that as not erroneous. The district says that the school increased its enrollment but did not increase instructional expenses. If you look between the second budget and the first budget, which is when the increase in enrollment took place, there's an increase in instructional expenses, a very substantial increase in instructional expenses. So that's just simply not accurate. So we have a resolution that has a handful of grounds, two of which we know are just false, are just wrong. They're errors. We don't even know if you remove those errors whether the local board would have voted the way it did, 3-2, to deny the resolution. The district then goes on to identify a number of things that it considers budget issues that I don't think are authentic budget issues, but let's talk about them, and you can look at them in a budgetary standpoint or a non-budgetary standpoint. We've already hit on one that Ms. Schroeder asked about, which is the issue of paraprofessionals. And it's true that paraprofessionals for the elementary classroom were cut between the second round of the budget and the third round of the budget. It was necessary to make the budget balance. That cut would be made up for by having vetted and appropriately trained volunteers aiding certified Montessori teachers in the classroom. I don't think that's not a budgetary issue. It could be an education. You could argue it as an educational issue, but it's simply not budgetary.
I would argue that it is. It is a budgetary issue.
Well, it's not, because we're not going to pay for paraprofessionals that we don't have.
Well, trained people in
which is an educational issue.
Dr. Flores, can we let him finish the answer, though?
Well, I was just trying to get at the point where, I mean, she hit at the point.
I want to hear his argument, though, about the budget.
Well, and I'm bringing up a question about the training of well-trained paraprofessionals in Montessori, and they have to be well-trained.
So, the other budgetary issue that we identified in going through the district's resolution was a cut in some of the supporting facilities costs, not the rental cost itself, but other costs related to facility. And the bulk of that is a cut in janitorial services. The school had originally budgeted for a janitor to be present every school day and for after-school cleaning as well, and cut that to be after-school cleaning only, and with teachers responsible for any cleaning during the day. That's not an ideal cut. In many ways, this is a bare-bones budget, which is one other thing I do want to come back to. We would confess that this is a budget that's been cut very sharply in order to meet the needs, the requests of the district in many respects. But it's a manageable budget, and it's certainly manageable as a good Montessori school. In addition, and if I could just add one other thing, the budget we're talking about here, the budget that has been discussed in all the briefs, is a budget that assumes that the school will not receive a public charter school grant. The school had applied for a public charter school grant. The grant was to be announced within the week after the JEFCO board decision. And one of the options was to approve this school application contingent upon whether that grant was received or not received.
we would accept that contingency. That contingency was perfectly acceptable to the charter school applicants and was suggested by the charter school applicants. Many of the items we're talking about could be covered if that grant was in fact received. Yes.
How much is that grant? How much is that grant, please?
Potentially $600,000, $200,000 per year for 3 years. So you'll see in some of the budget documents, you'll see an assumption of $180,000, but the potential is for $200,000.
Excuse me, I was going to ask a question. And the question is, so you're going to work with minority kids. I think that was kind of
A
significant number of minority kids, and yet you're going to cut on cleanliness, and you're going to cut on materials, and you're going to cut...
Thank you.
And you're going to cut on?
The materials,
the tools.
The cut would be on purchasing pre-made materials. One of the options in Montessori education is to make Montessori material. I mean, that's what Maria Montessori did.
Okay.
So one of the options is to make those materials. Right.
And I worked in a Montessori school, and I know how hard it is to be making those tools and as opposed to buying them. So... You know, it seems as if you're just not even, it's not even a Montessori school.
No, it's absolutely, it's not only a Montessori school, it's an AMI Montessori school. And AMI, which certifies these schools, wrote a letter of support saying this could be, under the plan as proposed, could be a Montessori school.
Right.
And I believe Ms. Gaunt has had a question several times.
Very quickly, the grant you're talking about is what we, in the vernacular, we know as startup grants.
Correct.
Does it include textbooks, materials, as well as program expense?
In terms of the details of what's in the grant proposal, I would defer to Ms. Mallon.
Okay.
Yes, it does. And that's where the budget without the CCSP, we were saying if we have to make things, we will. Knowing we have the CCSP, we know we have ample amount of money to go toward those Montessori materials from the very beginning.
So you do know you have that grant?
Yes. We actually found out the day after the Jeffco decision, unfortunately.
So all of this argument is about a budget that was no longer the real budget 24 hours after the decision was made, because the district would not consider passing this charter with a contingency that we would only proceed if we received the CSP grant, which it was known would be either awarded or not awarded within the next week. At that, I'd reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Ms. Edgar.
Thank you very much, Director, Chairman Durham, Dr. Anthes, and members of the State Board. I'm going to cut right to the point because I can tell there are going to be a lot of questions about budget, so I will skip a lot of my intro. At the heart of this appeal, you guys have pinpointed it. This is about a fundamental disagreement about the price tag associated with the model of the school that Great Work has proposed. Great Work sets that price tag at $1 figure. We set that price tag at another dollar figure. And that dollar figure is significantly higher than what is reflected in the Great Work budget. Now, before I get into what we see as the shortfalls of the Great Work budget, I want to talk about where we're coming from. We are
Mr. Mitchell, would have made any difference if you knew they had the $200,000 grant, if you'd known that at the meeting, or would that not have made any difference?
I would answer that by saying it would perhaps cause us to reevaluate, to look, you know, more carefully at things, but my belief was that even with the grant, this alternative or this proposal lacked financial accountability and responsibility. So even with it, I don't think it would get there. That's my opinion.
So is this area geographically, is it a relatively poor area? Would that be a fair description of the potential location of this school?
Absolutely.
So, are there other alternative elementary schools, any kinds of school choice available in this geographic area?
All of our schools, Chairman Durham, are choice schools. So
are there any choice charter schools anywhere near this area?
I'm going to defer that to our superintendent. I think near it, but not directly in the community, would be my answer.
That's correct.
So it's a non-served community in that regard. Then do most of your charter schools in Jefferson County have waiting lists? Let's start with the D. Evelyn School. It's traditionally had a waiting list. Does it?
Our charter schools have waiting lists, and a couple things you need to know about that is we believe that there's a significant number of students that are on multiple waiting lists, so getting to a
number. The existence of waiting lists for people who would like a better opportunity is a good thing?
I believe that people are looking for opportunities, and I believe that getting those waiting lists down to what the actual count is something we're very interested in doing, working with our charter schools.
So would it be helpful to add more charter schools? Would that help reduce your waiting list?
Well, I think there's a lot of variables that go into that, such as transportation. Someone can put their name on a list, but if the list that they're requesting is 20 miles from their house, that might be a transportation issue for them. Yeah.
But ultimately, that's a parent issue.
Okay.
Thank you. Right, Ms. Edgar.
Did you have a question?
I do. When you express a concern that this particular budget is inadequate, is that compared to the budgets of your other elementary or K-8 schools? Does it compare to the other Montessori schools? How does this particular budget, noting that it's a startup, which is a challenge anyway, how will it compare with the other Montessori schools? I'm assuming your other Montessori schools are both district and charter?
We have four Montessori schools, charters in our district, and Dr. Corbo and her team evaluated the cost of a Montessori education using those schools as the context. And our district staff has worked very closely with our charter schools over the long history of Jefferson County having charter schools. We have a great relationship with them, and we exchange ideas, and we have a very good idea of what a Montessori education costs. So Dr. Corbo can answer any specific financial questions that you have, but the fact is we work very closely with all of our Montessori schools and all of our charter schools to
all
make sure that budgets
work. All your Montessori
charters?
Is that what you're saying?
Not all of them.
Okay, so you have both district schools and...
We have a total of 16 charter schools, four of them Montessori.
And how long have those Montessori charters been in operation, and what demographic of neighborhood are they in?
Years.
I'm sorry.
I can answer some of them. So take Compass Montessori. That's been in existence for almost 20 years. I believe it was authorized back in about 1998. The other ones I think are newer than that. I think that's one of the more seasoned charter schools in our district.
And what kind of demographics neighborhood are they in?
They are in Golden, Wheat Ridge. Correct. And then we also have Free Horizon. Do you remember what?
That's up north, and then we have one down south. In the Columbine area.
Yep. So we are not saying by any means that this isn't an area that wouldn't benefit from a Montessori. This is not about us disagreeing with the proposal, with the location, with any of that. This is really about financials. And based on our experience overseeing four Montessori charter schools, which is the lens with which our financial staff reviewed the budget, we are not seeing the costs that are reflective of what the applicant has put in their application. And so let me talk about that, where they're having shortfalls in our opinion. They've represented a staffing ratio of 8 students to 1 teacher, which they had in their original application. And then they increased the enrollment, which was something we supported. The increase in enrollment gets you additional PPR, which that is really the only guaranteed, except for the grants, which they have, and we're not disputing that. That's the only guaranteed source of revenue. If they get kids enrolled, they get that PPR, and that is money that they can use.
But they also have a tuition-based preschool.
They do.
Well, right?
They do.
I understand what you're saying, that it may not be guaranteed, but...
Correct.
Of course, PPR is only guaranteed by actual students, too.
It is, and that's a great point, because their intent for their students to enroll the K-8, it's only 20. And they have assumed going into their budget that it's going to be 120. We see historically our charter schools have always, I repeat, always missed on their enrollment projections when they open. And it's just a matter of to what extent they miss, meaning they always say, here's what we believe we're going to enroll, and they always enroll less. Sometimes it's 25 students less.
Since you have waiting lists, I presume that they eventually grow into their enrollments?
No, that is not always the case in my experience.
So
absolutely
not. Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
They have always missed. The only certainty I can tell you is that they have always missed on their opening enrollment.
That wasn't the question I asked. If they stay open, do they meet their enrollment targets as they go forward? I mean, if they're waiting lists, I would presume that's the case.
No, they do not.
So why do you have a waiting list then?
That's the charter school's choice to have a waiting list.
So, for example, the question was, so they open and they miss their enrollment. Do they eventually, if I understand Chairman Dermott, do they grow over time so that eventually they hit their enrollment?
That's the question.
That is the goal, and that is when we're looking at a budget.
And you're saying that most charters do not?
No, I'm saying that is, they
okay,
do that, not
I think that was Chairman Durham's question.
They,
that, you know, yes, they may not meet it at the first year, but eventually they grow into
not,
their enrollment.
Sure, not all do. We have had in the last year.
So even though your charter schools in Jefferson County have wait lists, you're telling me that they do not meet their capacity?
Not
their
every
projection?
School has a wait list.
Okay.
There are pockets of schools that have a
I'm
wait
finding
list.
This a little hard to swallow, I have to
So, for example, in Golden, there is a wait list.
Yeah. So are you saying you only have one charter school with a wait list?
I don't know the details of all, but I know that all charter schools do not have a wait list. Really, the dominance of the wait list is in the Golden area.
Dr. Carbo, I wonder if you could succinctly tell us which particular items concern you when you compare the budget of this school with the budgets of the other, I guess, four Montessori schools, knowing that the capacity to raise dollars is probably greater in schools where you have a higher SES population.
I would say it would be specifically around salaries. The benchmark for a 200 FTE school is $2 million in salaries. This school is proposing 107 FTE, so if you just cut that in half, it would be roughly $1 million in salaries on the K-3 program. In addition to that, my main concern with looking at the original budget was that they had co-mingled the pre-K and the K-8. And when I was walking through the expenses truly seemed to align to the K-8 program, which is really just K-3 in the first year. But we saw the additional revenues from tuition. So we thought, okay, they included the revenues, but maybe not all the expenses, and then we asked them to break it out. K-8 being in one column, pre-K in the other for the total program. When we were looking and evaluating the K-8, walking from their application to the assumptions into the numbers that hit the budget, not all of the costs were there. We saw that there was an oversight on missing some teacher salaries in the budget based on what they intended to allow in the school, in the K-8 and in the total as well. We also noticed that there were benefits not included on some of the support staff. Four supported teachers that are benefit eligible were not included. In addition to that, their rent is on a per student basis. Those things weren't properly allocated between the two columns. So going down each line item.
Is there a legal requirement someplace in
there
state
is,
law for that allocation?
There is not. One of the questions to us was, how many FTE do we need for this K-8 program to work? How much PPR dollars? In order to be able to give them a benchmark target, I need to understand what the real costs are for the K-8 program. When things weren't properly allocated, were included in the assumptions but not in the budget, when all of the costs for the teachers that they said they were going to have in there were not included, I could not give that answer. So,
are they allowed to set their own teacher salaries?
Correct. When they had the teacher salary and the number of teachers that they said they were going to provide, that dollar amount was not in the budget. And so in order for me to financially do my responsibility of evaluating the budget, I'm using the information that they provided me in order to evaluate what was in the budget. In order to answer the question of how many FTE you need, what you say you're going to do, I needed to see that in the budget. So that one proportional allocation in isolation isn't really the issue. It's the fact that there are costs not included that they had in their assumptions and that they had in their application.
When you were concerned about the
I was going to ask the question. There was a disparity between special ed kids and how much money they had allocated for special ed kids, and it seemed that there was a discrepancy in that area. Could you explain?
Sure. The initial budget had 70 FTE. They added 30 extra children. During this time, there was no additional monies allocated for special ed. Historically, the district has seen 10%. There was a conversation between two of the district members, not including myself, with the treasurer, specifically asking questions. Special ed is charged by the district and supported by the district, but in addition, you have revenues and expenses for your own staff to provide special ed. So there's two components. It's a little complicated. We thought the component of having your staff and charging the revenue to get that offset was not included. That conversation was made. When the budget came back, there were additional students. Only the revenue piece was added to the budget. The cost for special ed remained the same. We still had questions, and had that been articulated to us that everything was included, that would be fine. We still had that as one open question. There are multiple other questions we had with the budget. However, if you do add 30 extra kids, you would expect there to be some additional support to follow those 30 extra students.
My concern, too, is this is a Montessori school, and you have 30 kids in elementary school per one teacher. And to me, that is so out of line, because usually the number in Montessori is much lower, too, because of the program and because of all that needs to be done. So it could be as low as 16. So I'm saying you guys are putting 30 in second grade and third grade and first grade when there should be 16 kids for that model. I'm talking Montessori now.
There was a concern of trained staff or using paraprofessionals or teacher volunteers and having that training go with the teachers. There's also concern with having the teachers teach, clean, and build materials when there are already not enough teachers included with materials. By excluding the materials and building the materials, there was some concern around that.
Yes.
In addition to expenses, and I'm sorry, I'm jumping in, there was also concern with revenue. Because going into the intended target market, where it's 82% free and reduced, they're assuming that they're going to collect 30% in the budget. However, the application said 45%. There's a disparity. It doesn't matter. Regardless, if you do hit the intended market, the sliding scale of tuition is going to be less than what is assumed in the budget. And there is a concern for less revenue. In addition to revenue for PPR funding, having the students in to get the PPR, at the time, and I know that their letters of intent have increased, there are 20 students included in the application for the K-3 program. PPR is funded on K-3. Historically speaking,
5 minutes,
letters of intent have been more than what was allocated in the budget, and there's still a miss of 25 students, which is roughly $185,000, not including our last school that missed by 100 students. So our concern of not having the proper funding on that is also a concern with not enough expenses.
What happened to the school that missed by 100 students?
They have letters of intent for more than their budget.
Are they open?
They are open, and they are struggling, and they are having to they're struggling.
But they're open.
They're open, and they're struggling, and they're cutting staff, and they're having to go out and find loans. And so some of the programs that they're trying to deliver, they're trying to figure out ways to make those things happen. And there are more than what's allocated in this budget here.
Dr. Carbo, can you explain why you use a 30-60 allocation for the rent when, in fact, the student numbers are, 87 to 107?
Yes, so actually I should explain that because this is a lesson to me. We should let the finance people talk this out. So in the brief, I have a math error. Here's how we came up with the allocation, right? 60 plus 40 is 100. And I missed that. Here's how the allocation works. They start with 77.4 FTE, right? But that's actually 90 kids. So 77.4 talks about funding. Kindergarten students are funded at 0.58. So you have 77.4 fully funded students, but that's 90 bodies. And then you have 80 bodies in the pre-K. So then they increase enrollment by 30 students, and those students are in the grades 1, 2, and 3. So those are full bodies, fully funded. So that's 120. That's 120 to then now still 80 in the pre-K, so it's 200. So in looking at the cost and trying to see where we trying to figure out where we thought they were missing it so we could give feedback, we wanted to see a cost allocation for a number of things that was more along that 60-40 spread, right? 60% of the kids are going to be in the K-8, 40% are going to be in the pre-K. Now, some of that doesn't work, but take their facility lease. Their facility lease is actually quite unique. It is on a per-student basis. So it is 100 square feet per student. That's how it escalates at $8 a square foot. So if you are really wanting to show your costs so that we can help say, we think you're low here, we think you're missing stuff here, what we ask them is, can you pull it out and show it properly allocated? And the reason that helps us and that would help them is that then they know, looking at the two programs, which yes, are part of one whole school, but looking at the two programs, one of which is tuition-based, one of which is PPR-based, it helps them see the revenue streams and the expense streams for both of them. Then they can look at those programs and learn how to analyze those and see, okay, we're going to have a deficit in our K-8. That happens in startups. What's it going to be, and what do we need to hit from a tuition standpoint to offset that? And we don't have a problem with that. So it just helps us figure out their costs and tell them where they need to be in certain assumptions.
Can I ask, did you have face-to-face meetings to discuss these, or was this just a paper back and forth?
Yeah. There was one face-to-face meeting, is my understanding. And the reality is, it is Great Works' responsibility at the time of application to submit a school and a budget that is economically sound. End of story. We support our districts through the application process till it gets to the board and provide ourselves a resource, but we cannot do their job for them. We cannot. We can provide feedback as they ask for it. We were able to do one meeting. There were calls, as I understand it, between the parties, and we did our best to support them. But part of our struggle was we couldn't figure out what they were costing and where they were putting it.
Well, Mr. Mitchell's already said even a couple $100,000, which if I understand the number of students, which is several thousand dollars per student, wouldn't have made any difference. So I don't know if the conversation would have been particularly relevant.
I would like to know what is it that a school has to have in order to qualify, because it seems to me there must be some threshold of either number of kids or something that causes you to say they're not going to have enough money or they are going to have enough money. And if that's the case,
sure,
that needs to be a public policy on the part of your board that says, school, don't come to us unless you've got solid letters of intent of what, 250, 300, something? Because I'm feeling, unless I'm completely misunderstanding this, I'm feeling that it's based, since the revenues are per pupil revenues, basically, that it's going to be the number of kids.
Can I answer that?
Yes.
Okay.
Your time has concluded. Thank you.
We'll get back to that.
All right, Mr. Bethke, you have 10 minutes.
Thank
for
you.
About.
On the last point, the discussion about the possibility of adding a classroom was the difference between the second and the third budget. And one of the things that I believe is going on is that the district would like to see perhaps another classroom added, and that's not a conversation that's even taken place yet. So the school has not closed the door to considering further modifications if they would solve some of the budgets, some of the district's budgetary concerns. You know, and Mr. Chairman, I read Mr. Mitchell's statement a little differently. He said that if there was a $200,000 grant, that would be cause for the local board to reevaluate this. That's what this appeal is about.
I think he said it wouldn't have made any difference to him.
It probably wouldn't have made any difference to him. But he's one member of a board, and if there's cause for the local board to reevaluate, that's grounds for remanding this case to the local board to reevaluate. That should be the end of this appeal. That's essentially saying we've got new facts that should cause this local board to reconsider. So I think that's decisive. There have been I do want to get to your question. There have been a couple of things I want to hit real quickly. There was a statement that the application said that there would be an 8-to-1 student-teacher ratio. That's incorrect. 8-to-1 would be a potential adult-to-student ratio. That's including paraprofessionals. The AMI standards for Montessori classrooms are to have 24 to 35 students per classroom, but multiple adults under one teacher within that classroom. That's a very standard Montessori practice. Yes.
Can you speak to the governance in terms of parental engagement? there's much said about how many parents are on the board, when they're
The board has always included parents. The district asked for, the plan has always included parents. The district asked for more parent-elected members to be on the board, and the school agreed. So the school essentially adopted what the district requested, which was increasing the number of parent-elected boards to be a majority of the board. And that's not an issue in this appeal. It wasn't flagged in the resolution at all.
That sounds like it's not a grassroots effort.
No, it is a grassroots effort, and it's not an issue in this appeal. It's not a legitimate issue before this board.
Thank you.
May I ask this question? I have seen and I read, I'm familiar with the student-teacher ratio projections, I'm wondering, what I don't have clear in my head is actual numbers of kids per grade level and how that would impact the hiring and would also impact the sustainability of the entire school. If you're looking at a build-out expansion by grade level, that's one thing. If you're looking at expansion by numbers, that's quite a different, I think, to me anyway, in planning for that. So to clarify would be good if next year, suppose there is an opening, next year third grade is the top grade, the intention is that by every year you will expand a grade level.
Yes, there's 30 children at each grade level, and as those children move up in a grade, we add that grade.
Okay, and is also there an intended projection picture that in the future, those kids who are in the preschool program will continue on with you. And that goes to my basic question of where specifically in Jefferson County is this located? And if there is any specific projection of data available about how that area, the intersection if possible, is projected to grow. And will there be a sustained population in that particular part of Jeffco? I know kind of where you're talking about, and I understand that. I guess the articulation area would be helpful to me to ponder that. But those would be some questions. I'm concerned about the beginning of as in preschool, and then the potential for expansion on a pretty systematic schedule into other grades. If we can't tell from your projected budget that all of those kinds of facts have been included, I'm finding some, I have a need. That's where I am.
It is our intention that the children enroll into our preschool, and through the CCSP lottery guidelines, we are allowed to lottery in 2.7 years in advance, so that lets them lottery into our preschool, and then they stay in our program. The evidence of supporting disadvantaged students with early childhood education is so significant that we know that if we can scoop up those kids early and keep them in our program, then that'll best serve them. And we know we're not adding new students to the top, we're adding from the bottom, so every year we're adding new preschoolers. Mm-hmm. And our letters of intent to show there's a high demand for early childhood education, especially that's affordable in that area.
Yeah. And I would just add that the letters of intent show very significant demand for the preschool and also are distributed socioeconomically much as the school has expected them to be, so that the tuition expectation is realistic. The enrollment, what the criticism has been, that the enrollment is weak at the elementary level, at the 1-3 classroom. And again, we would accept enrollment milestones. This is a common practice to say, you know, your charter is only granted conditioned upon by May 1st you have to have 80% of your full enrollment, or you have to, and by July 1st you have to have 95%, or whatever those numbers are and whatever those dates are. Those are common conditions in granting charter applications. We would accept such conditions. So you know, we're willing to have the enrollment piece of this monitored. That is the risk that charter schools take on startup. And I want to emphasize the startup point. There was a mention of taking salaries at Compass Montessori, which has been in existence for 20 years, and Montessori Peaks, which has been in existence for 13 years, and Free Horizon, which has been in existence at least a decade, and taking those salaries and dividing them in order to arrive at the salaries of a startup staff. That's a bogus financial procedure. The cost of long-serving teachers is significantly greater than the cost of teachers who are being hired for the first time in a startup school. We all know that.
Ms. Rankin.
Mr. Bethke, is it correct to assume that the Montessori schools go into a new area and start knowing they're going to lose money? Wouldn't their financial situation be such that they would not go into it if there was a chance that they would go under?
Well, 5 minutes, Mr. Bethke.
I think, I'm not sure I completely follow your question, but I think what you're saying is, do we believe that they're intentionally designing themselves to be insolvent? And the answer is no.
That's the answer I wanted. Thank you.
Okay. A little less than 5 minutes.
Okay. The other, let me see if there's another point. This whole talk about the price tag of the model, I've already mentioned the teacher salary point of it, but there isn't a specific price tag for Montessori as a model of education. There's a price that's been derived from 3 veteran Montessori schools that have been around and been able to save money, been able to accumulate money over a long period of time, build out their programs. Compus Montessori has one of the only Montessori high schools between the Mississippi River and the Pacific Ocean. They've been able to build an extensive program, including a higher cost high school, including what they call the farm school, which is their middle school. That's not a valid comparison for a startup, whether it's at the teacher salary level or anywhere else. We seem to have financial analysis here that's being done on a very superficial basis, and I agree the financial conversation didn't end. It got cut short because we ran up against the deadline for the board to make a decision, and I would just come back to Mr. Mitchell's comment. We have cause to reevaluate. We have cause to reevaluate, and that's cause for this board to vote to remand this case for that reevaluation. Thank you.
Okay. Do you yield the balance of your time then? Okay, very good.
I'd love to have served a bottle, but I don't think Kristen will hear.
Yeah, it's not allowed. No, I will not. So one of those things. All right, Ms. Edgar.
Thank you. So a couple things I want to address. One, I'm not going to revisit what Dr. Corbo has gone over in detail. Here's the bottom line.
Let me ask her a question as long as we're getting there. Did you discount starting salaries versus salaries of very experienced teachers in your analysis?
So when I use the existing schools as a benchmark to get it down to the same FTE, it was roughly $1 million. They have just a little bit over $500,000. So even though teachers have been in schools for a number of years, I wouldn't expect the difference to be 50%.
Would over 20 years if you look at salary schedules and steps. Presuming they're on that kind of mode, salary schedules and steps between a starting teacher and somebody who's been at it 20 years with an advanced degree is at least 50%.
And here's what we are taking. Again, I want to get to the bottom line. We are judging this school against its proposed self. They made the proposals. They made the staffing recommendations. They said in their application that a critical piece of their opening and being this AMI certified Montessori.
Excuse me, Dr. Corbo just said she didn't judge it against itself. She judged it against 3 other schools.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. What I'm saying is this. We're looking at what they're saying in the application, and we're carrying that forward. We're looking at what they're saying in terms of staffing ratios. We're looking at what they're saying in terms of having critical furniture, fixtures, materials in place to operate this school. That's in their application. We take that at face value. That's the school they want to operate. Notwithstanding that, they are not, and they did not carry those costs through to the final budget. They're missing salaries and staff based on their ratios. They're significantly missing furniture, fixtures, equipment, supplies, and materials. And this panel has already identified the issues with that, not having clean schools, having to build materials, putting more strains and demand on teacher time. So there's that. The revenue stream is uncertain at this point beyond PPR for what they can enroll, which is 20 kids. The tuition on a sliding scale based on their demographic, we think they've overestimated that. We think they've overestimated their fees. And we believe they will miss their target enrollment just like every other school. So at the end of this, that deficit, from considering all of that, that deficit exceeds their ending revenue in their budget together with their charter school startup grant, they're in the red. And when we run that forward, we don't see that get into the black. Here's the other thing. We don't make a point of opening a school that's going to struggle from the get-go. That does not make sense for our kids. We are not pro-charter or anti-charter. We are pro-choice for good, sustainable schools. And opening a school that's going to struggle from the get-go, that is not going to be good for those kids. That is not a choice. You heard Dr. Corbo, the school that is struggling is not able to deliver on their programmatic commitments to the community that they made. And we do not want to do that. So we are here today. We take our fiscal responsibility as the authorizing district quite seriously. We have made our decisions based on our informed experience about what this school should reflect in terms of expenses and what it can reflect in terms of revenue. And that number, when you take it in actuality, not just what's on paper, when you take that in actuality based on what we think it should be, it does not balance. And we don't want to open a school that is going to struggle or fail. Thank you.
Yielding the balance of your time?
I do.
Thank you. Okay, that will conclude the...
Can we ask questions?
Not of these, no. Well, if you have time left, yes, that's correct. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Schroeder. Yes, Dr. Flores?
Yeah, I think your charter's cutting corners, and it's going to be more expensive.
Questions of this group. This is the only group that's still...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well...
Yeah, we'll get to debate later, but if you have questions, it can at the present time it can only be of the district.
Okay.
And where are we, Ms. Cordial?
Just over 5 minutes.
Okay. So you guys are fast.
Great. Okay. So. Okay.
Do you have a question then for the district,
I do.
Dr. Forrest?
How many minority kids? Can you, ESL poor kids? Special ed kids, do you think, are in those letters? And is that a concern for you?
I haven't seen those letters, but what I can tell you is in their application, they had 20 letters of intent. At the point of our board's making a decision, verbally, we were told they had 124 students, I believe, that were in their letters of intent, and you heard them say that they have upwards of 185. We have not seen those letters of intent. I have no basis to be able to judge what types of students are within those letters of intent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
Masnick. Do you usually see the actual letters of intent, or do you actually don't you actually get like addresses so that you know what schools they're actually would be drawing from?
So I can tell you what our past practice has been in Jeffco is that we have a really rigorous process. It's been approved by the Charter School Institute, the League of Charter Schools, and CDE. We've worked in partnership with them. It entails an extensive process of application, of review by two groups, of a cabinet recommendation. We have never had to go into a school and talk about letters of intent because usually those numbers are overwhelming. During the time I've been superintendent in Jeffco, we have had three other charter applications. One of those charter applications opened with about 450 students.
But do you see the actual letters of intent usually?
We do not see the letters of intent. However, last year when we opened a charter school, we had them tell us they had 250 letters of intent, and they opened with 150. So we are reevaluating how rigorous we need to be as a district in terms of making sure that those letters of intent are actual people that are going to enroll in those schools if we're going to get this close to the number of being a viable option for students. In my estimation as a superintendent, the worst thing that we could do is open a school, especially in a highly impacted area, and have those students have to battle through two or three transitions because as adults and as authorizers, we haven't made a strong decision that that building can stay open and provide a high quality education that we expect to have happen in Jefferson County schools.
Further questions? I think we're about at the end of the time. All right. Thank you very much. Well, that will conclude the oral argument. Okay. The board will now deliberate and reach a decision. Any questions or comments from the board? Not questions of the parties.
Do you want a motion first, or do we?
Yes, Dr. Schroeder, would you like to make a motion, please?
Oh, oops.
Somewhere.
I'm working on it. I move that the charter applicant has proven by preponderance of the evidence that the decisions of the local board was contrary to the best interests of the pupils, the school district, or community, and move to remand this matter to Jefferson County School District number R-1 for reconsideration.
It's a proper motion. Is there a second? Ms. Masnick seconds the motion. Discussion of the motion.
Do I have to discuss it?
No, nobody's obligated to discuss it if you wish to provide a reason.
I'll discuss it. Yes, Dr. So Schultz. I have definitely struggled with this because I do worry about the kids. And I get a lot of feedback when we have approved a charter school, and as was pointed out by Councilor Edgar, not necessarily all the kids come. And the complaint I hear is then it takes a lot of work on the part of the district and the board to help those schools kind of move forward. And that's unacceptable or offensive. And my own personal feelings are is that these kids are your kids. All of them are. And to the extent that it becomes necessary to give more than a single face-to-face meeting with a charter bothers me a lot. And I come from a different background. I come from a district where we've had charters for a very long time. And while initially there were some concerns, I think the board there has just gone over backwards to say, these are our kids, we're gonna do everything we can. And I really would like to see you have some more conversations. What I'm comfortable about is that if there is no way to make this work, that you come back to us and say there really is no way to make this work. But I would like more specificity. Unfortunately, I'm a recovering CPA, and so I rather struggled with the lack of specificity on some of these things. When there are allocations, those are just allocations, and they are not, you know, they're not written in stone. We know that those are just allocations, and you can make numbers or you can make the bottom line look different when you make those allocations. And so I really have struggled with some of the detail here simply because this happens to be my sandbox. So if you have to come back to us, if you can't figure out how to help these almost 200 kids get a school started, that you provide much more concrete data as to why not. I worry that there is some threshold of a number of kids that there has to be around in order to start a charter school. If that's the case, that's fine, but then that's what we need to talk about. Because the revenues, the state revenues that go to this charter, this particular school, should be the same state revenues that go to all the Jeffco schools. And so I can't quite figure out why we can't make it work. I want to point out that one of the schools in my district, and I honestly can't even remember whether it was a charter school or just a choice school, they had no janitorial service. That's not a horrible thing. They had a very clean school. And particularly Montessori kids.
Without janitors, it couldn't be clean.
Yeah. It was extremely.
Well,
and the kids did it.
And it takes time away from teaching.
Well,
it's not fair.
At least they don't have to haul wood like my grandmother.
So parents came in. My point being that some of the accommodations and some of the really, really bare bones kinds of things that these folks are talking about have been done other times. They've been effective. They've worked. They're not ideal. I'll recognize that. But I don't know. It's not so bad to have the kids learn how to clean up after themselves. Gets dicey when you get to the bathrooms. But other than that, it's very, very doable. So I want to make sure that the things that you're most concerned about are really harmful to children. So that's my vote.
Dr. Flores?
I wonder if you would say that in an upper middle class community in your school.
Yes.
But we can say this. We can say this for minority kids, that they're shortchanging, they're cutting corners, they're not doing enough for I mean, 50% of the budget they're going to start out. It's unacceptable. It's unacceptable that you would think that a janitorial service is not important for little kids. It is very important. And I know in other states, they think that cleanliness is very important. And I'm sorry that this board, or part of this board, doesn't think that cleanliness is next to godliness. Come on. So.
Only in non-governmental context. Ms. Masnick.
Well, Dr. Flores, first of all, I think you have mischaracterized what the board, some members of this board have said about cleanliness. I think what...
Well,
I'm thinking back to when Castle Rock Academy started their first charter. How many years was that? 1993. And I was familiar with a lot of the parents and founders of that. They built that school in a strip mall, and all the parents were doing the drywall and the painting and everything. And my grandmother was a teacher. She not only had to sweep the floor and clean the entire, she had to haul the wood in and sometimes had to cut it. So I think it's kind of overwrought to act as if not having janitorial services to the extent that many of our neighborhood schools do is somehow making these children live in filth. No, it's not. It's making adjustments where needed, because what they're really trying to provide is choice and a different model for these children. And these children are underprivileged, low income. They deserve a chance for an option other than their neighborhood public school. So I cannot fault them, and this is not a question and answer session. I'm just responding to what you said. I'd also like to thank Dr. Schroeder for what she said. I really appreciated her bringing that out, that it's not the worst thing that ever happened if children help clean classrooms and if teachers do. Thank you.
But it's the poor and the poor.
May I?
Yes, Ms. Goff.
You know, thinking back, we've all mentioned a little bit here and there about the history of charter schools and the quality of authorizing and a long history of standards being set, which I listened, not differently, but with a slightly turned perspective when it comes to Jefferson County. I have had the good fortune of direct experience with the start of the charter movement in Jeffco, and have been around for some trying times because they were new. And it was a new adventure. It was an acknowledgement that choice, be it charters or our option schools, which are not necessarily technically charters, they offer another option. Jeffco has come to be known as one of the most efficient, most fair processes in the country. And I have heard this from others in my counterpart positions in lots of different ways. Something that I think our district and our charter schools have to be very proud of. The other aspect of that is the area of the district in which the school is proposed to be located is important, because it involves Dr. Flores's points about the student body being possibly served. It also has long-term ramifications on that area of Jeffco, which therefore impacts the greater area surrounding that school. That is something that the citizens of Jefferson County have been paying a lot of attention to, especially in the recent 2 to 3 years, the entire area, which is unique in where it is. We share a lot with the large metropolitan capital city of our state, Denver. We also have the unique qualities that are all present in Jefferson County. It's
challenging can be taken wrong, but it's an adventurous place to be opening schools and to be serving students. I appreciate heartily the changing times, and overall, we live in a time where you never really expect one thing to happen on any one day, and it goes back and forth. The timing of the grant news, the timing of the one-on-one meeting, the timing of this particular hearing, it's always interesting. We can't always control that. I am attuned very closely into the needs of the minority students. My interest in asking questions about the projected growth of the population in general, which absolutely ties in, I believe, with the demographics that result from that, is very important. I have had hints today that perhaps the conversation is not quite straightened out yet. I can't help but think that perhaps one more try at squaring away, whether it's data, whether it's understanding, whether it's clarity on a timeline, it just seems like there's a little gap there. On the other hand, as well, I find that the budget confusion and sporadic omissions or overlooking oversight, although probably not intended whatsoever, I find that upsetting when we're all in a position where we have to decide this is money that is rare, it is precious, we want it to serve the best point possible and be used in the right way. I do find it, I'm having trouble finding ease with that context, and I'm thinking that for now, if I had my way, I would say, are there other ways to investigate an approach to this other than saying, you know, this type of contingency or condition has to be put on it? Perhaps that's best. Sometimes we have to get really specific and technical. So I thank you all. You have done a yeoman's job of presenting your points, all of you, and I appreciate the intention and the good heart and minds for kids in this situation. I would ask that as the vote occurs, each of us puts that back as our main focus on a vote today.
Yes, Dr. Sheffin.
Yeah, I just want to also say thank you for the hard work on both sides to think through these, puzzle through these important issues. I think to me it's great if parents have options. The Montessori model is so well positioned for all kinds of students, especially those who are challenged. And it de-emphasizes standardized testing, it's procedural learning, and so I think if the details can be worked out, having an option, another option, Jeffco, for students and families is a great idea and really benefits the district. So thank you.
Yes, Dr. Ford.
I'm very concerned that this is the very first time in 2 years where we have not given the option for parents in the community to come speak before us, and that really concerns me. I don't see precedence for this, because I think that parents, the community, is a very important part. They know their communities, and we should have heard them. I'm sorry, and I if we're going back on this, and we're never going to hear from them, if this is the time to hear, it's the only time we hear from these families and these communities. And I don't think we should set precedents by saying that we're not going to hear them.
Let me address that first, if there are no other comments. Dr. Flores, it's long been practice to allow public comments on issues that may be pending before the board. That's perfectly appropriate unless they're quasi-judicial. And I think I've struggled for the last 14 or 15 months that I've been privileged to be the chair as to whether or not I thought that was appropriate. I was always uncomfortable with it, and I think allowing it in the past was a mistake and could very well have jeopardized a decision made by the board because we had heard improperly received information. So I think the ruling and I think the advice of counsel is correct, that we really should confine ourselves to the comments that are made in the record which we receive and then on the record by the parties. And so I would guess, and it's just a guess, but I would guess had we listened to those who wish to testify, I'm going to guess they were all, if not the vast majority, in favor of the granting of this charter. And you know, while I would have been interested in hearing their comments, I just don't think it's legally appropriate. So I'll address that, and I will take responsibility for making a mistake in the past and ruling improperly on whether or not we should have allowed testimony. I do not think we should have, and that's on me since I made those decisions in the past.
So all those hundreds of letters that we've read before sometimes on issues such as this, does that mean that we should not be allowed to read those letters and that constituents shouldn't come to us and talk to us about these issues? I mean, that's what we were voted to do, listen to them.
I think we have indeed been elected to make certain decisions. The legislature has constrained us in this particular decision-making to a quasi-judicial role. And right, wrong, or indifferent, that's the decision that they made. And I would view most of the testimony we might receive on these issues or parent comment or otherwise as frankly being harmless and not likely to influence a member of this board against the weight of evidence that is in the record and presented. But it certainly looks better, and I think it complies with the intent of the General Assembly and the statutes they've passed if we don't. Now, that's certainly not always going to be my decision to make, but to the extent it is, as I said in the past, when I failed to make that particular ruling, I believe I was in error, and I hope it's been corrected. And it will be perhaps for the board going forward to revisit some of those procedural issues. Yes, Dr. Schroeder.
I appreciate, Val, your concerns, but I want to point out that I hope that at the time that the Jefferson County School Board listened to this application, that they had significant input from the parents on either side of the issue. So there is definitely a time for input from the parents, and it's at the school board level. It's at the school district level. That's when you want your proponents and opponents to come forward and share with the board what their feelings are. In our case, unfortunately, because it's quasi-judicial, and no, I don't want a robe.
But this is
we're in a different. We're in a comp.
The powdered wig, though.
Different. I do not want a powdered wig. Bad hair, despite the bad hair days that I tend to have.
See, I'm trying to deal with my no hair days. No, so,
do you know what I'm saying, Val? There is definitely an opportunity. I don't mean to preach. I just want to make sure that we're very clear that there is definitely an important role for the folks who are interested in this. But since we are in a completely different position, we don't get to be the ones that hear it.
And all
the board needs to hear it.
This has never been.
It is new, and I certainly admit that, Dr. Flores, and it's something I've contemplated for a long time, and I just believe that the policy and the ruling I made is better supported by the law than previous rulings.
That was my point.
Yeah. I'll blame Mr. Dill wherever he is. And let me just say on the merits of the case, we have a demographic area where 82% of the kids are free and reduced lunch eligible. We know, as a matter of absolute fact, that those children do not all thrive in traditional environments. I think we know that they can benefit from options that can be made available to them, and this Montessori is one of those options. To trap poor kids in situations without options, I think, is terribly, not only inappropriate, it goes well beyond being inappropriate. But additionally, I would say the standard that the board wishes to apply, which is almost a guarantee of success, you know, the statistics in the real world, 9 out of 10 startup businesses fail. Just a fact of life. Now, obviously, none of us want to be in a situation where 9 out of 10 startup charter schools fail. And obviously, they don't. Our scrutiny of those and authorizing agencies is pretty good. Do some of them fail? Yes. To not allow opportunities to guarantee against failure is to guarantee that people will not have options, that kids will be trapped in, poor kids particularly, will be trapped in substandard schools, and that there will be a dearth of innovation, no opportunities to try new ideas, to improve education. And I just think the standard which the board wishes to apply is unrealistic, that this is not a risk-free world. And I would think that it's in the best interest of the people of Jefferson County, and certainly of these particular students, it's in their best interest for them to be allowed to assume a little risk, recognizing that failure is a possibility, although based on what I heard today, I think failure is unlikely, and I intend to vote yes. Ms. Cordia, will you call the roll, please?
Excuse me.
Yes.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. It's only because you brought it up.
Okay.
In 2016, there was a report about where kids in the country of the in the United States would do the best. Minority kids, poor kids, would do the best in the country. And, of course, guess where? Jefferson County. If there is a poor kid, the U.S. Department of Education's report said that there was no place in the country better to live, to have kids, than in Jefferson County. And I guess that really stuck in my mind, that their schools are better and that minority kids who go to Jefferson County would have a much better chance to do well than anywhere else. And now we're giving them an experiment. It's not funded. I've looked at lots of proposals. That's what I do. I've read lots of proposals on what is good for kids. And I would say that this would not cut it, given the financial problems that it has. So I would say no. I like Montessori. I think it's great. And I guess I wouldn't have trained in such a program if I didn't think it was great. But in a sense, we're going to experiment with these kids in a district that is known for quality and giving quality to poor and minority kids. Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
Ms. Gorgia, would you call the roll, please?
Board Member Flores.
No.
Board Member Goff.
Can I hear the motion?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Would you repeat the motion, Ms. Gorgia?
Sorry, but I need to hear it. Go ahead.
The motion was that to move that the charter applicant has proven by a preponderance, thank you, of the evidence that the decision of the local board was contrary to the best interests of the pupils, the school district, or community, and to move to remand this matter to Jefferson County School District for reconsideration.
Ms. Goff.
No.
Board Member Masnick.
Yes.
Board Member Rinken.
Yes.
Board Member Scheffel.
Yes.
Board Member Schroeder.
Yes.
And Chairman Durham.
Yes. That motion is adopted on a vote of 5-2. Thank you very much.
Oh, there's one other.
Yep.
We have to designate a board member to...
Two board members. To work with me in order to create the order.
I'll designate Dr. Scheffel and Ms. Rankin to do that, and when would you expect to have that available for signature? Tomorrow?
I'm going to come up and talk to you each after this right now.
That's too
okay.
Big.
And we should get it out tomorrow, yeah. Or even by the end of today.
All right,
today.
Do you want
to?
You shouldn't
yep.
have two on the prevailing side.
So you have to always
yeah, you always
that.
Have two yeah. on the prevailing
no,
side.
I just forgot about that.
Thank
no, you. Okay.
Anyway. You don't want.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. All right, now where are we? Oh, yeah. We're going to take a break. Ms. Cordia, why don't you read us into executive session? Then we'll clear the room and get started.
Sure. An executive session has been noticed for today's state board meeting in conformance with 246-402-3A CRS to receive legal advice on specific legal questions pursuant to 246-402-3A Roman numeral 2 CRS in matters required to be kept confidential by federal law or rules or state statutes pursuant to 246-402-3A Roman numeral 3 CRS and pursuant to 246-402-3B Roman numeral 1 CRS concerning the evaluation, I'm sorry, concerning the wrong language. Concerning the appointment or employment of an official or, yeah.
And Dr. Scheffel, would you second the motion? It's been moved to second. Is there objection? Requires 3/5. Hearing none, that motion is declared adopted. We will now proceed into executive session,
Thank
and we'll
you.
Take a 5-minute recess.